When we were last in Ecclesiastes, which was a week ago before our Easter meeting, I sketched out for you the overall pattern of verses 20, chapter 2, verse 24, through the end of chapter 3, chapter 3, verse 22, and suggested to you that it was a symmetrical structure highlighting three big ideas. The first idea, the one with which the passage opens and with which it closes, and the idea also reflected at its very center, is the admonition to enjoy life, to take pleasure in one's labor. And then there are two other themes that are built around this. One is a reminder that God is the God of the extremes. You can't simplify God and say, well, he does the good things and the bad things in the world, he's out of control, he can't help those. You can't go to a dualistic philosophy such as the ancient Persians had, where everything good was one God, the good God, and everything bad was the bad God, and the good God and the bad God were always fighting against one another. That's not the position that Mr. Preacher holds up before us. His claim is that our God is the God of the extremes. He is so big that he is absolutely sovereign. He is in control over everything that happens. The third idea is that God has given man frustration. The frustration in our lives is not the result of accident. It's something that God has placed there for a purpose, to direct our attention toward him. And out of all of this, we have the exhortation that we should enjoy life and receive it as God's gift to us. Now, the last time we studied here, we worked from chapter 2, verse 24, down through chapter 3, verse 8. This opening paragraph in chapter 3 is the famous passage about the times. To everything there is a season and a time, to every purpose under heaven. And the preacher took us through seven different subject areas and claimed that in each of these areas, the opposites that come up are appropriate, each in its own time. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. You can't say that death is always untimely or inappropriate. Sometimes death fits beautifully in a way that life does not. You cannot say that laughter is always good and mourning is always out of place. Sometimes it's appropriate to mourn. Sometimes it's appropriate to weep, and it would be very inappropriate to laugh. All the opposites in life, we tend to classify them as desirable versus undesirable, as good versus bad, as intentional versus accidental. But Kohelet wants us to stand back and say, God's in control of the whole thing. There is a time for everything, everything in its time. Now, from this emphasis, we go on now in verse 9 of chapter 3, verses 9 through 11, to face this rather bold claim that the frustration that we experience in our daily lives is something that God gives to us. Chapter 3, verses 9 through 11. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his, or perhaps better, its time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Now, you've seen verse 9 before. What profit hath he that laboreth in that wherein he laboreth? That's just chapter 1, verse 3. We started the book this way. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? What good is it? What good is all the work that we do? In fact, verse 10 also echoes chapter 1. Verse 10 suggests that God has given us this suffering, this travail, this frustration. And that also is in chapter 1, verse 13. I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. God has given us a sore travail. He's given us a frustrating, difficult task. And verse 11 tells us in detail how he's done this. It sets up three statements that we should consider. First of all, God has made everything beautiful in its time. Second, he has set the world in our hearts. And third, we cannot find out the work that he makes from the beginning to the end. First of all, he has made everything beautiful in his time. Hebrew does not distinguish between him and it. There is no neuter in Hebrew. Everything is either masculine or feminine. And we can just as well translate his here as it. We're not talking about God's time. Rather, we're saying, in light of the first eight verses, God has made everything beautiful in its time. There is a time to be born and a time to die. Birth is beautiful in its time. Death is beautiful in its time. It fits. It's appropriate. There is a time to weep and a time to laugh. Laughter is appropriate in its time. Weeping is appropriate in its time. God has made everything beautiful in its time. God has constructed this world in all of its complexity in such a way that everything fits together. And in fact, we realize that. If you consider great works of literary or dramatic art, the ones that have attained reputation as being masterpieces are not all light, frothy humor, nor are they all doom and gloom. They weave together skillfully the things that we consider happiness and the things that we consider sadness. Last time I quoted for you a little snippet of a poem that compared sadness and happiness in life to dark and light colors that a weaver might use to construct a tapestry. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Now, this is the first thing that we have to understand this God-given frustration. Our God is the God of the extremes. Everything fits in its own time. He's put it there for a purpose. And now we go on to read in verse 11 that he has set the world in our hearts. The Hebrew term for world also means eternity. He has set eternity in our hearts. This comes very close to being a paraphrase of the sentiment with which Augustine opens his Confessions, where he says concerning God that you have made us for yourself and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. God has put an emptiness inside of us that's approximately the size of eternity. We know that we are meant for something more than this life. We know deep down inside that the boundaries of our 70 years and 10 are not it. This is the same sentiment that Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1 when he claims that men know God. Naturally they know God. That knowledge is embedded in them. They're born with that knowledge. Even when they say, no, there is no God, they're denying their own consciousness. Man has a sense of the eternal, a sense of the supernatural embedded within him. And yet we face the inevitability of death. We face a finite limit on our lifetime, and so we can never grasp that which we're reaching for. We know that we are creatures of eternity, and yet we always come up against this wall. We die, and there we stop. And that's got to lead to frustration. Here is God, supremely, completely in control, making everything appropriate in its own time. Here are we, utterly out of control and inconsistent. Huge hunger in ourselves because we know that we are creatures of eternity and yet we are constrained by time and by space. This leads us to search, to seek, to try to understand God and His ways, to try to understand what there is beyond ourselves, beyond our own boundaries. But of course we cannot. We are finite. We are creatures, and he is the creator. And so verse 11 ends, no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. We search and search, but we're beating our heads against the wall. We cannot find the answer. If this sounds very philosophical, recognize that you're dealing here with the wisest man who ever lived. I really think what King Solomon is doing in this line of thought here is leading out for us the consequences of us being finite, limited creatures of an infinite, unlimited creator. It really can't be any other way. If God really has formed us in his own image and yet made us finite, restricted, and he is infinite, there's always going to be this sense of frustration. We're always going to be hungering after him. That's what Kohelet senses. That's what Augustine sensed. That's what Paul sensed in Romans chapter 1. There is frustration in our life, yes, but it's there because God has given it to us. It's not there as an accident of a capricious and mean-spirited universe. It's there because we are the finite creatures of an infinite creator. In the light of that, this frustration that we face on every side, we turn our attention again to the exhortation in verses 12 and 13 that we should enjoy life. I know, this is verse 12, that there is no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Verse 12. We read this before, back in chapter 2, verse 24. I know that there is no good in them. That's exactly how verse 24 begins in the Hebrew. There is no good in man. Paul said that. In me that is in my flesh that dwells no good thing. But there's a qualification. There is no good in men but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Here's the only thing that's good in us. Here is the one thing that we should do, that we should strive after. Rejoice and do good in our life. I wonder whether the believers who wrote down the Westminster Catechism had this verse in mind when they posed the first question. Now, we're not a creedal church. We don't pay a lot of attention to the various formalizations and formulations that people have written down of Christian doctrine down through the ages. But sometimes it's interesting to see where those various confessions and creeds capture biblical insights. The Westminster Confession is a series, or catechism rather, is a series of questions that were written to instruct people in the Christian faith. And the idea is if you memorize the questions and then memorize the answers that went with them, you'd have a nice little theological understanding of the world. Many people were brought up with the Westminster Catechism or some other catechism like it. Brian Sietsma, for instance, memorized the Heidelberg Catechism. He can still spin that off for you just like that. A certain kind of church tradition proceeds in its education in that way. Well, here is the very first question in the Westminster Catechism. What is the chief end of man? What good is man? What's man for? What is the chief end of man? And the response is, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. It's a very famous question and answer. You'll often hear that. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Well, look carefully at verse 12. I know that there is no good in them, but here's the only thing that's good for man, man's chief end, is to rejoice and to do good in his life. To glorify God is to do good, is to obey his will, to serve him. And to enjoy God forever is surely to rejoice, if anything is. So if you like, you can look at verse 12 as proof that Kohelet was a Presbyterian. He must have memorized the Westminster Catechism because he agrees with this sentiment that the only thing worthwhile in life is to do good, to serve God, and to rejoice, to enjoy him and the gifts that he gives to us. That's it, folks. That's it. The only thing that's good in our whole existence is to obey God, to serve him, do good, and to enjoy him and the gifts he gives to us. Verse 13 states this in another way. Also, that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, it is the gift of God. It's God's gift that enables us to enjoy life. Same three things here that we saw back in verse 24. Eat, drink, and enjoy good in our labor. And we don't do that in our own strength. That's not something that we can stir ourselves up to do. It is something that God gives to us. It is the gift of God. So the same sentiments as chapter 2, verse 24, come out again down in chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. And now Kohelet will lead us back up the other side of our symmetric structure, and he'll lead us again to think of the frustration that surrounds us that God has given to us. Verses 14 and 15, chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, that is added to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. Now we're back here to the issue of eternity. He tells us about eternity here. There is a reference to forever in verses 14 and 15. Whatever God does, it shall be forever. And man is frustrated because of God's eternity and his own finiteness. You see that at the beginning both of 14 and 15. Verse 14 says that whatever God does shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it nor anything taken away from it. You can't change what God has done. You can't change God's revelation and make true false or false true. You can't change God's sovereign determinations in the history of the world. You can't even change the weather. Whatever God does is done. You can't change it. You can't add to it. You can't take away from it. Verse 15, the first part of the verse says the same thing. That which hath been is now. That which is to be hath been already. Everything is all fixed. Here is God making everything beautiful in its own time. Here is God arranging the universe. And although you feel somehow that you ought to be involved with it, you can't change it. You can't manipulate it at all. But there is an effect that this has on us in our relationship to God. This time we look at the end of both verses. The end of verse 14 tells us, God does it that men should fear before him. Why has God set himself up as the sovereign ruler in the universe and made us utterly ineffectual in everything that we try to do? So that we should fear before him. Why is God in control and we here are finite creatures? So that we might fear before him. He wants us to fear him. He wants us to recognize that he is in control. He wants us to obey him. Would we do that if we thought we could change his word and his will? No, of course we wouldn't. We would live to please ourselves. He has locked us up in a universe that's bigger than we are, a universe that we can never control, to lead us to fear him. And in return, he takes care of us. The end of verse 15 sounds a little confusing. God requireth that which is past. Literally, God seeks that which is pursued. That's probably not a whole lot clearer, is it? God seeks that which is pursued. I think that which is pursued here is a reference to us. Chased hither and thither by all the confusion and busyness of our lives. Remember how important busyness is to Mr. Preacher's thought. He's always talking about how busy we are. We're running around. We're chasing around. Here we are as though we are pursued, as though we are wild beasts being chased. I remember a couple of weeks ago when the guppies were in the tank over there and they were separated behind the glass trying to feed the blue dolphin down in the corner. Well, I noticed one of the guppies snuck around the side of the glass, and all of a sudden that zebra-striped fish caught sight of the guppy. and the zebrafish would go, and the guppy would go off in this direction. The zebrafish would turn and zoom after it, and the guppy would dive down. And then I guess the zebrafish had a full stomach because he wasn't interested in chasing any further until 5 minutes later when he catch sight of the guppy again, and they start all over again. Boy, did that guppy move. I tell you, with the zebrafish on his tail, he recognized he was about to become a fish dinner, and he didn't like that one bit. That's the way we are. We are chased. We are pursued. I know that any of the men here that works in an industrial environment can vouch for that kind of a situation. We are chased around like mad. Well, guys, Mr. Preacher doesn't say that's really going to change. He doesn't tell us to stop being pursued. We are pursued. There's no question about it. But he does give us this encouragement. God seeks that which is pursued. God is watching over us. He is taking care of us. We are not alone in all this hectic, frenetic running that we're part of. He is watching us. He's caring for us. He has placed us in a frustrating environment, but he's not left us alone there. He will provide for us. So these two sections emphasize for us that God is in control of the frustration that we feel, the problems that we face. Now we come back up to verses 16 to 21, which corresponds to the first 8 verses, the verses that talked about the time to be born and the time to die, so on and so forth. I'll read verses 16 through 21. Moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness that iniquity was there. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in mine heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts, for that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast, for all is vanity. All go unto one place. All are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? And we have a little clue as to how this paragraph is put together. It's longer than some of the others that we've studied. Notice it begins in verse 16 with an observation. I saw under the sun. Then in verse 18 you have an explanation. In verse 17 rather. I said in mine heart. And verse 18 again. I said in mine heart. I saw something. I made an observation. And then I reflected on it, and here's the conclusion I reached. I said in mine heart, I said in mine heart. So we have one observation and two conclusions. One observation and two explanations of that observation. The first observation, the observation, what we start with in verse 16, is that wickedness and righteousness are all mixed up. I saw under the sun the place of judgment. He's probably thinking here of a courtroom. Or the seat where the judge sits to render judgment when the criminals come before him. And you'd like to think that judges are good people, that they're righteous, they always make right decisions. But Mr. Preacher looks at the place of judgment, and what does he see? Wickedness was there. The judge is crooked. He takes bribes. And the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. What is the place of righteousness? Here, perhaps, we're thinking of a truly good man. We're thinking of a person who seeks to obey God's law. But when you look real hard at somebody like that, even there, you'll find iniquity. Back to Paul's idea. I know that in me that is in my flesh dwells no good thing. To will is present with me, but how to do that which I desire, I know not. The observation. Everything is all mixed up. It's bad enough for the world to have good over here and bad over here and to claim that God's in control of all that. That was verses 1 through 8. But now what he says is, okay, so we've got the good and the bad. If you look real hard at the good, you'll even see the bad there. You can't separate it neatly into two pieces. The structure of good and bad in the world is, to use one of my favorite terms, fractal. No matter what detail you look at it in, you still see the mixture. You can't get it apart. It's all mingled together. How come? How can we live with this kind of a consequence? How can we cope with it? Well, first consideration in verse 17. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and every work. Well, the second part of the verse is very familiar. That's just the first eight verses all over again. There is a time for every purpose and for every work. God is the God of the extremes. He structured the world so that everything fits. And in particular, the time will come when God will judge the righteous and the wicked. God will sort it out. You may not be able to. You may not be able to discern the righteous judge from the false judge, or the righteous actions of a man from actions that are motivated by greed and by selfishness. We don't even know ourselves in these things very well, do we? But God is able to sort those things out. God will judge the righteous and the wicked. There is a time for everything. There is a time for righteousness and wickedness to be mingled together. There is a time for God to sort them out and to bring judgment. And again, this is a very much a New Testament sentiment. Look, if you will, at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Not chapter 2, chapter 1. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. Verse 3. We are bound to thank God always for you, brethren, as it is meet, because that your faith groweth exceedingly, and the charity of every one of you all toward each other aboundeth, so that we ourselves glory in you. We boast about you in the churches of God for your patience and faith in all your persecutions and tribulations that you endure. This church was undergoing suffering, persecution, tribulation. Yet they were showing great patience and faith in the midst of that persecution. And that is a manifest token of the righteous judgment of God, that you may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God, for which you also suffer. This is very strange. Why should good people suffer? Why should the righteous be persecuted? We thought about this last week in 2 Peter, didn't we? Here are the righteous being persecuted, being trodden down for their righteous deeds. This is exactly what Kohelet is talking about. I looked in the place of judgment. Wickedness was there. I looked in the place of righteousness. Iniquity was there. It's all scrambled. The righteous suffer, the wicked triumph. But Paul's answer to that problem is the same as Kohelet's. Verse 6, seeing it is a righteous thing with God to recompense or repay tribulation to them that trouble you. God will bring tribulation, suffering, trouble to those who give you trouble. If you suffer as a Christian, God will even the score. Now, if you suffer just because you're a mean person, then you'll suffer for that yourself. But if you suffer for righteousness' sake, if you suffer and people mock you and ridicule you because you are a Christian, God is going to even the score. He will repay tribulation to those that trouble you. He's keeping count. And for every pound of difficulty they give you, he's going to repay them difficulty. And to you who are troubled, verse 7, he will give rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power, when he shall come to be glorified in his saints and to be admired in all them that believe, because our testimony among you was believed in that day. Punishment is coming. Payday is coming someday. There is a disturbing tendency in modern religion, including much that calls itself Christianity, to want to do away with the notion of a final judgment. A real tendency to deny the existence of hell, to deny the wrath of God. But if you throw that out, you throw out the solution to this big puzzle of the mixture of evil and good in the world. Where is the justice? Evil permeates everything that we look at. And if there is no judgment someday, The only conclusion that we can reach is that good is not really good and evil is not really evil. The world is not black and white, it's really sort of gray. And that also is a characteristic of modern religion, that there isn't any such thing as real absolute good or real absolute evil. Everything is relative, and it doesn't much matter what you do. Just do something significant and be tolerant. That's all. Be tolerant and be significant. Nothing else matters. That, of course, is not the Bible's position. The Bible says there is good, there is evil. You may have a hard time sorting the threads out from one another. That's okay. One day God will bring judgment, and at that point, it'll be clear what's righteous and what's unrighteous. So that's one answer to the dilemma. Are wickedness and righteousness mixed together? The second answer is in verses 18 through 21. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, I know the reason for this. The purpose for this mixture of good and evil is that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they are that they themselves are beasts. There's a little bit of an ellipsis here. I said concerning the estate of the sons of men, they are in that condition so that God could show them what they are. If unsaved men could live lives of crisply delineated good and evil, if we in ourselves could sort that out, then we wouldn't recognize how fallen we are. Even the unbeliever can see the injustice in the world. Even the unbeliever thus can be driven to the fact of sin. He can be forced to recognize that he is just a beast. Back to the confessions again. According to the compendium of the Christian religion, there are three things that everybody needs to know. Francis, do you remember what they are? Good. Three things everybody needs to know. How sinful I am, how to get out of that sin, and how to thank God for getting me out of it. Francis gave us the exact wording. I haven't memorized the exact wording. Well, this is the first step along that path. The first thing that everybody needs to know is our misery and sin, how sinful we are. And that's what Mr. Preacher says. The reason God has let evil and goodness be mixed together is to force indelibly upon everybody's mind what a terrible state they're in, so that they would recognize that they're sinners. He goes on to show the common observation that is clear to everybody. Here we are, men with such lofty thoughts, and yet that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath. A man hath no preeminence above a beast. All is vanity. They both die. This is modern man's assessment of man's place in the universe. And this apparently was an assessment that was common in Kohelet's day. People, they die. They rot and they go away, just like animals do. He thought that was a new idea, that man is just an animal. It was widely circulated here, 3,000 years ago. And no one notices the crucial difference. No one sees the one thing that distinguishes man from the beast. That's verse 21. Who among all these people, frustrated with the mixture of evil and good in the world, seeing themselves as nothing more than beasts, driven to recognize their bestiality, who among them all recognizes the essential truth that the spirit of man goes up and the spirit of the beast goes down to the earth? Kohelet sees that difference. But he says, you know, all these people out here, they don't see it. They don't recognize it. They think they're just animals. And in fact, that's really what God is trying to show them. He's trying to prove to them their bestiality by confronting them with the effects of sin day by day in their lives. That's why he allows wickedness in the place of judgment, iniquity in the place of righteousness. He's the God of the extremes, you see. He uses sin and righteousness alike to accomplish his purposes. He's not guilty for the sin. Scripture's quite clear on that. He does not tempt men, and he himself is not tempted with evil. But it all fits into his overarching sovereign plan, which is to direct men to himself. So the conclusion of the whole matter in verse 22 is where we started and what we saw at the middle. You can't simplify the world down in some Pollyanna statement that, well, you know, the good is real and the bad, well, that's just a bad dream and it'll go away. Just neglect it. There's frustration in the world. It's frustration that God has put there. He's put it there to direct our attention toward Him, to force us to recognize that we are finite and He is infinite. Our only position can be, in the words of verse 22, I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works. For that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Rejoice in your own works. That is your portion. This ought to sound familiar. Look at 2:10. Back in the section where Mr. Preacher was trying out pleasure. Remember, he was trying the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Back when he was trying out pleasure, he said this, whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. But then he goes on to say, it's all vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit. Now here, very strangely, he says, I'm going to rejoice in my own works. That is my portion, and that's good. There's a subtle difference between the two, which you cannot see in the English translation. The difference is, well, you can almost see it. In verse 22, 3:22, a man should rejoice in his own works. In verse 10 of chapter 2, there he said, my heart rejoiced from my labor. This was my portion of all my labor. Now, it's not consistent in English. English uses the in verse 10. In chapter 2, we're talking about rejoicing from labor. In chapter 3, we're talking about rejoicing in labor. To take one's portion from labor, to rejoice from your labor, is to have the idea that I'm going to work and work and work and work, and as a result of my work, the outcome of everything I work for, that's what's going to bring me pleasure. I've got this image that way down the road somewhere is this thing that I'm building, this thing that I'm working for, and when I finally get there, I'm going to have satisfaction from my labor, as a result of my labor, satisfaction that I build as a result of everything that I do. That's futile. That will never happen. Do not expect a portion from your labor. You're going to be disappointed. Instead, chapter 3, find your portion in your labor. In the daily rhythm of life. The breath that God lets you breathe, the food that He gives you on the table, the company of other human beings that He entrusts you with. That's it. Right there. Rejoice in your labor. God's given you your labor. It's your portion. God has portioned it out to you. It's like a serving of cake on a dish. Maybe you want more cake than you got served. Well, you can't have more cake than you got served. But that's no reason not to enjoy the cake that you have been given. You see the contrast between the two? He's turning our attention away from the driving ambition that says work, 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 work for satisfaction. And one that says, you're going to labor. God has given you this labor. You've got to do it. You might as well find joy in it, day by day, in the small things of life. Because you can't count on anything future. Who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? You can't count on any future fame or accomplishment on this earth. Right now is all you have. So you might as well enjoy it. So that's what we come to through this third chapter. Remember, up until we hit chapter 2, verse 24, we were all looking at life under the sun. No divine influence. At chapter 2, verse 24, for the first time, we began to see God in the equation. When we did that, we were forced to see that God is the God of the extremes. He is a sovereign God. who has ultimate control both over good and over evil and has made everything beautiful in its own time. Because he is so big and we are so small, we are faced up with frustration day after day in our lives. And in fact, there's a reason for that frustration. God wants us to see that we're beasts. He wants us to know our misery and our need so that we will turn to him for salvation. He wants us to fear him. In the midst of this all, he tells us there is joy, there is happiness that you can have in the midst of your labor. In fact, this is the point that he makes three times over in this section. 2:24 to 26, 3:12 to 13, 3:22. There is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. There is no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Glorify God and enjoy him forever. Also, that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God.